Welcome, everybody, to episode 179 of the Metabolist 2 podcast, which features myself, Ben.
And I am David. And we're alone.
There is no guest.
Classic format.
Classic format. Then the surprise is that it's not a surprise there's no guest.
Yep, it's just the two of us.
Yep. Back to the original form. How many weeks have we had guests now for? I can't remember.
Month and a half, so probably six, seven guests.
Yeah, and we do love our guests. Let there be no mistake. Our guests are awesome. But we've run out of them. We have no more people that we know who like Doctor Who.
We tapped out, and now we get to wrap up Tom Baker's era with season 18.
Season 18. Season 18 is a low ebb for me for watching Doctor Who. Regular listeners of the podcast will know that this is when I went away to school, 1980 or so, and was too busy trying to get on being at boarding school than to spend a lot of time watching Doctor Who. So, plus, again, what I discovered, certainly the bit of boarding school that I was at, no one was watching Doctor Who, so I either had to watch it on my own.
Right.
And then risk being beaten up, leaving. There was a so the TV in my first house at school was actually in a cabin, like on the edge of a field, quite some distance away from the main living area.
Uh-huh.
So in order to go and watch television, you really had to kind of, you know, mark yourself out as going to do something. And Saturdays when this was on, you didn't really want to kind of, you know, oh, look, there's the kid who's going to watch Doctor Who. So
right. You didn't want to stand out at...
No.
Did you go off to school at 14, 15, younger?
13.
13.
Just before, so I had my 14th birthday in the first term.
14th.
In the first term. Okay. So I would have been, when I went away, I was 13, but then I was almost immediately 14.
So I was seeing these as a younger age, and I really noticed the difference, I think, like everyone, because the credits had changed with the Leisure Hive, and we no longer had the blue time tunnel. We had the Starfield, and that was impressive. And I didn't really pick up at that age that something had changed that dramatically, because we still had Tom Baker and Lala Ward, so we had still the Doctor and Romana. K-9 was there. K-9's voice was back to normal. And it seemed like things were going along pretty well, and it wasn't until really the abrupt change of Romana leaving that I began to go, this doesn't seem right anymore. In retrospect, you know, looking at it through adult eyes, it is wildly different of a season, just in terms of music and direction and storytelling.
Yeah.
But as a 12-year-old, I didn't really pick up on all that.
Huh. Yeah, I mean, I'm just having quickly reviewed season 18 to kind of try and refresh my memories of this. I didn't see the Leisure Hive. I didn't see Megloss. And I think I only really saw The Leisure Hive and Megloss when I got them on DVD.
Right.
It took me that long to watch it.
Really?
I do remember seeing bits of Full Circle, but also remember not enjoying Adric joining. I remember seeing at least, I guess, some of the later episodes of State of Decay. I did watch Warrior's Gate, and then I think the first couple of episodes of Keeper of Tarkin. Yeah, I would have gone back to school kind of mid-January, and then it was Legopolis, and then the whole thing was done. So
for me, going into E-Space was really fascinating. I thought this whole idea of this alternative or this negative universe, as a 12-year-old, again, this was like my head was going, pow! This was like a huge revelation. I was thinking, you know, because at that time I was getting a magazine in the United States called Odyssey, which was all about the space program, astronomy. It really seemed sci-fi to me. It seemed to be very mature. Like, oh, there's E-Space. That's a trip to the encyclopedia. Again, not finding anything about E-Space in the encyclopedia, but it's sort of like, surely this had to be based on science somewhere. And it, again.
So you were one of those, like, well, I can't remember what the Bidmead phrase is, but you're one of those kind of scientific teens that he was after.
Yeah, I was like 12 years old and reading things about NASA. The space shuttle was only 2 years old when I saw this in 82 or 81, 82. And it was coming off of Empire Strikes Back. It just seemed to be capturing the modernity or capturing sci-fi, what was really right. popular. And so you had the Starliner in for Full Circle, and right. they're in E-Space. And then we go straight into the Terrence Dick story, State of Decay, which the wasting made an immediate migration for me into Dungeons and Dragons with vampires and stuff. So it just slotted in really, really well. It wasn't until the next one, Warrior's Gate, with Romana leaving, that's what I really remember about it, that I was going, wait a minute. Because for me, Doctor Who really didn't start leaving impressions the first time I watched it until season 16 with The Key to Time. And so Romana was almost my first companion. And then to have Romana go, it was weird. I didn't understand what was going. I thought, like I've told so many times, that
right.
there was going to be a Romana spinoff show where we were going to follow Romana and K-9 around in E-Space with the lion people, the Tharls. It never happened, of course, but that's when things started to change for me. And then things started really changing very quickly, because we go into The Keeper of Tarkin, and this character, the Master, which I don't remember the Deadly Assassin from the first time around. So who is this guy? Why? What is this relationship with the Doctor? Why is he cackling like that? And then we get Legopolis, and Tom Baker's gone. So it was really, quickly.
Right. So you'd not seen the Deadly Assassin.
I had, but Doctor Who wasn't making an impression with me until The Pirate Planet, the first time around I watched it.
Yeah, well, so here's a couple of things for me. So I was intrigued. I remember being intrigued by the prospect of E-Space, mm-hmm. but then I also remember being kind of disappointed that it just appeared to be exactly the same as normal space, yes. only it had E in front of it. I guess I was expecting it to be more extraordinary or different, mm-hmm. and I possibly wasn't paying full attention, and possibly still aren't paying full attention. But I was never really able to discern a major difference between E-Space and normal space.
I think so, too. I couldn't tell really any difference other than the coordinates of Gallifrey were the coordinates of Alzarius. That was the big difference, and then people healed faster in E-Space for whatever reason, or Adric healed faster.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I mean, I think in some ways it was a wasted opportunity. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it seemed to me it was a thing they'd come up with, like so many things on Doctor Who. You know, you come up with the idea, okay, we're going to do this now, and then, we've just forgotten about it.
I thought it was really a wasted opportunity, because they were three and done, three and out.
Yeah, exactly.
So they go through this charged vacuum embodiment or whatever, aboitment.
Aboitment.
And they're in E-Space, but then it's sort of like how the disappointment with Jodie Whittaker's first season, where I thought it would be all about finding the TARDIS after a whole long series.
Similar, and, yes, absolutely.
And E-Space was three and out. They easily found a way out, in my opinion, because they get in Full Circle. They have a minor delay with State of Decay, and we learn this great backstory about how the Time Lords fought their great enemy, the great vampires, with bow ships, and that was really cool, because I thought maybe we'd see later on like a Gallifreyan space battle with vampires versus Time Lords. That would have been epic.
Would have been cool.
And then we're at this really kind of, I still don't know how to describe it, but Warrior's Gate, which is really more adult sci-fi than kids sci-fi. And they're out. The Doctor escapes, and we don't have Romana and K-9 anymore. So it seemed like, yeah, E-Space could have went on for forever.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the fact that Adric is from E-Space mm-hmm. potentially gives him kind of powers of some kind,
right?
Which, other than, you know, basically being a knob,
there's mathematical excellence.
Well, exactly. It doesn't really seem to have any powers. So yeah, I don't know. Yeah, which was also, I mean, I didn't like Adric. I was roughly the same age as mm-hmm. Adric was supposed to be, mm-hmm. only obviously slightly younger than Matthew Waterhouse, but right. And my reaction, and again, I think the idea of the production crew was, or the production team was, that, you know, Adric would be an audience identifier for the kind of, you know, nerdy males that I guess they had identified as being their prime audience.
Right.
I remember, again, very strongly, just feeling that I was being pandered to. And I resented that. I didn't want people who were like me. I was bored of being myself. Mm-hmm. I wanted people who weren't like me. That's the kind of people I was interested in.
Like Australian air hostesses.
Australian air hostesses, you know, virtually immortal aliens from the planet Gallifrey. You know, anybody, you know, monsters.
Right.
You know, if it was someone who was like me, well, then what's the point? I'm like me, and I don't watch TV in order to watch people like myself.
Yeah.
And I, in some ways, I still think that that's, you know, I consume media to find out about other experiences other than my own experience. And then I think the other piece, I mean, I really kind of reassessed Logopolis in my kind of, you know, my kind of head appreciative canon listing. I like it very much now. I think it's so stylish and well written, and it has a good balance of sci-fi slowness with revelations and stuff. At the time, again, I was bitterly disappointed. I mean, I love Jeffrey Beaver's performance now, and Jeffrey Beaver's, you know, he's a mainstay of Masters on Big Finish, and he does an excellent Master. But I was bitterly disappointed that it wasn't, you know, the proper crispy Master from Deadly Assassin, because I had adored the Deadly Assassin, and I still, you know, rate the Deadly Assassin very, very highly. But the fact that, you know, Beavers, he wasn't wearing a mask, his, you know, for whatever reason, they decided they would just paint his teeth onto his lips.
Right.
Which, you know, even now is like, I'm not sure that was the best decision.
Right.
Give him cracked, horrible lips, but, you know, let him use his own teeth.
Right.
And I was like, well, this isn't the Master that I like the most, which is Delgado. And obviously that's not because he's dead. And B, it's not the Master I like the second best, because that was the only other Master that I knew, which was Crispy Master from Deadly Assassin. So yeah. That's two bits of kind of dislike there for this season from me. And again, as I said before, I really saw Tom not really seem to enjoy himself anymore. Which, again, I mean, I think one can overstate that. But, you know, he didn't look as active and engaged as I'd seen him before. And I think part of this was the performance that he was being asked to do. So, you know, tone it down. And I don't think he was enjoying being told to tone it down. And I don't think he was enjoying having to act with his ex-wife, or at least a wife that he was regretting having married.
Well, they didn't get married until after they were done filming.
Oh, really? I thought they'd broken up by then.
No, they broke up. Oh, geez. I'm not a... once they leave screen, I don't really pay attention to their lives. But I believe they got divorced in 82 and got married in January of 81.
Maybe they were just having a girlfriend-boyfriend argument. I'm looking it up now. Thomas Stewart Baker. In December 1980, he married Lala Ward.
Yes.
In April 1982, the marriage dissolved and the pair divorced. So I guess, yeah, okay. So when he was filming this, it was before they'd got married. Okay. Well, yeah. Okay. I stand corrected. But anyway, I mean, they didn't seem, I don't know,
they weren't enjoying each other's company. And I think the crew was pretty surprised that Tom and Lala actually tied the knot, because on State of Decay, they were not getting along at all. And you can tell that they won't even look at each other a lot of times when they're delivering lines.
Right.
So it's, he was not a happy actor at this. And I think saddling him with a rookie, a novice actor like Waterhouse was further demoralizing.
Exactly. And not even a rookie who realized that he was a rookie by all accounts, but someone who was pretty intent on being the best actor on the show when clearly he wasn't. And again, I mean, I think this is another thing that disappointed me about Matthew Waterhouse and Adric, is that I could see that the acting wasn't very good, and it seemed like Again, it seemed to me throughout my childhood that one of the great thing about Doctor Who is that it was an adult's kid show. It seemed to me that this was a show that kids watched, but it was basically the people who were in it were adults, mm-hmm. and they were acting as adults. It was like a grown-up show for kids.
Right.
And it seemed to me the addition for Adric made it into a kid show. There was a child actor in it who was roughly the same age as I was, and he was good at acting. Which just reminded me of all the other child actors on all the other BBC kid shows, which were child actors not acting very well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and again, you know, one has reformed one's view of Matthew Waterhouse and Adric by this time in my life. But at that time, it was like, what is this? You know, this is not my show anymore.
Right.
You know, they've made it into something else, and I don't mm-hmm. like what they made it into.
Well, I think even if they had cast an established young actor, like what they did with Sarah Sutton, who played Nyssa,
yeah.
you'd have a much more professional, much more credible performance. And I think Tom would have reacted accordingly for so. But to have someone with one, I think, television credit to his name and who is working working the mailroom was probably not the best way to say, look, Tom, we really respect your show. We really respect you.
Right.
Instead, it seemed kind of disrespectful to
me. Yeah. And again, I mean, one doesn't want to slander anyone, but I mean, I think in you know, reading around this, one does get the strong impression that Matthew Waterhouse was cast because John Nathan Turner fancied him.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that's... I mean, I don't think it's ever been written down anywhere, but that is the kind of the impression that I get, which is, you know, fair. You know, he's the producer. He can cast anyone he wants. But I think they probably should have spent slightly more time trying to find someone who was able to act at the same level as, you know, Lala Ward and Tom Baker. And as you've just pointed out, you know, Sarah Sutton.
Janet Fielding was significantly a better actor than Waterhouse. And I think it sets up what's to come in season 19. You have this crowded TARDIS where you have a lot of the personalities brushing up and antagonizing each other. And it's not very good drama when one of them kind of lets down on the acting side of it, I guess, because with the scripts that are being provided for Doctor Who, a lot of it has to come from the actors themselves.
Yeah, if you have an ensemble cast and part of the drama is the way that ensemble cast relate to each other as travelers in time and space,
right?
You know, they've all got to be kind of equally good actors.
Yeah.
And again, you know, Matthew Waterhouse is obviously a lovely man. You know, he's a big supporter of the show now. You know, he's doing Big Finish. He's contributing to the Blu-rays, but he wasn't a good choice at the time.
At the time, yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in your reprisal of Legopolis, what do you make of The Watcher? Because The Watcher is unique in regeneration sequences, and I know you've had thoughts on regeneration.
Yeah, so I mean, so Keeper of Traken and then Legopolis, which, you know, there are two that I kind of enjoy now.
Right.
I mean, The Watcher, I mean, you know, as much as I've said before, you know, I don't enjoy the, what's the word? The kind of long tail of regeneration that we have to have nowadays, mm-hmm. or certainly we had in the 80s. The kind of lead up was actually pretty fun. And The Watcher, this kind of mysterious figure kind of hanging around, is actually kind of mysterious and is sort of useful. I don't like the plaintive kind of fluty sound that The Watcher engenders when you spy him across a crowded room or on the edge of a field. But anyway, yeah, you know, all the Legolopolitans, and their funny clothes, and I mean, there's a lot to enjoy.
Yeah. The Watcher for me, I thought, was pretty creepy in ways. And since this was my first regeneration, I was always on the lookout for The Watcher. Then in the future, in throughout the 80s, with thinking
you were disappointed.
I just thought that was part of the normal regeneration.
Oh,
that's
interesting.
Because it's your first impression that, okay, you're going to see this ghost image of the Doctor of the future when it's time for the Doctor of the present to leave. And
no, you aren't.
It sets up expectations, and it is a unique regeneration in that There is a Watcher, and it's never really explained, I think, in any subsequent story, or even in Legopolis, why the Watcher for the Fourth Doctor comes into play.
No, I mean, I don't think it is. I don't think it does, and I don't think... Has anyone ever explained it? Has it been explained in kind of fan fiction, or in... I mean,
I haven't gone looking very far for it, but I don't know of it.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's that interested. I mean, Big Finish have surely done, you know, The Adventures of the Watcher.
Tegan and the Watcher,
exactly.
Companion Chronicles. The Watcher Chronicles.
Yeah, Tegan and the Watcher have adventures.
You promised me Heathrow.
Fluty noise. And the problem, of course, with Tegan and the Watcher is that Tegan's having the adventure and the Watcher's just standing
idly by,
a quarter of a mile away, just kind of watching her have an adventure. Mm-hmm. He's not actually very helpful.
She's changing the flat tire in a car, and the Watcher's just watching.
Yeah, he just sits. He just watches. Yeah, I like to watch. Yeah.
The voyeur. Could have called him the voyeur.
Yeah, he's like, yeah, exactly. It's like being there with Peter Sellers. He's just like, I like to watch.
He was the voyeur all along.
Yeah, it's you know, and yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's the Watcher's kind of a fun, silly thing now, mm-hmm. which I think, you know, it's
a meme.
He's enjoyable as a kind of a piece of Doctor Who camp. Mm-hmm. I mean, this mm-hmm. is where, you know, this is it's during this season that, you know, Doctor Who really kind of starts to. For me, starts to kind of acquire its campness. It becomes sillier and sillier, which again, I think nowadays I can appreciate, because all of Doctor Who is pretty silly, but at the time I felt...
It's a silly concept.
Yeah, at the time I was like, you know, this is my serious show. This is the show that, as I said, you know, that adults don't know about.
Right.
It's a secret between, you know, kids and the BBC that we have this awesome show that we can watch. And it seemed to me that, you know, it was kind of getting away from that piece that I enjoyed.
Which is kind of ironic because John Nathan Turner wanted to tone down the silliness. And that was seen as a hallmark of Douglas Adams and Graham Williams' season 17, and in many ways they turned up the silliness in a different direction, I guess, with Ainley cackling and his antics a bit, I guess.
Yeah. I was excited. I mean, we're not supposed to be talking about this in this episode of the Metabolist 2 podcast, but I was very much reinvigorated when Peter Davison started. I thought, okay, they've got a new doctor. Mm-hmm. I know who the doctor is. I still don't like Adric, but I do like Nyssa. I do like Tegan. Okay, maybe they're going to get this going again.
Right.
And they sort of don't. But, you know, I really, really gave the show the benefit of the doubt in the kind of early Davison years. And anyway, so, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah, so that's kind of the highlights, I guess, for season 18.
It's, well, I mean, I think for both of us, it's not a high point.
Mm-mm. I think it's difficult for me to have it as a high point because it's the final year of Tom.
Yeah.
And then in retrospect, you lose the doctor that I imprinted on. That's, you know, your first doctor. So that's hard to kind of watch. And I think, from a story-wise standpoint, the high point for me are like the story that Terrence Dix wrote for a much younger Tom Baker, you know, a season 15 Tom Baker and Leela. So you kind of wonder now, and as an adult watching, what the story would have been like in Graham Williams' first year.
Right, right.
If they made it up in Birmingham and Pebble Mill, for example.
Right.
And then the other one that I think is really a classic, and I think it's just because it's so different, is Warrior's Gate. And I think stylistically, it's probably one of the most incredible Doctor Who's made in the 70s, but I guess it was made in the 80s. I guess the closest parallel I think would be like the Mind Robber, but it's very, very different. And I think it works on a modern level. I think it's one of the episodes that you could tell today without really a lot of rewrite.
Yeah, and I think season 18 is an interesting season. There's a lot of interesting things going on. And, well, you know, I mean, I guess I do a podcast on Doctor Who, so you know, I am interested in the show. It's not a season that I spend a lot of time going back to and go, oh yes, I need to watch Megalos tonight because I love that one. It's not a well that I go back to very often. And certainly sitting here talking to you about it, I think, well, yeah, maybe I should give this whole thing another chance and spend more time, you know, because as I think we've said with some of our guests, Warrior's Gate is incredibly interesting and unique. And State of Decay is, you know, it's Hammer Horror. It's a Hammer Horror pantomime of some kind, which, again, is super interesting. I've just said how much, you know, I like both Legopolis and Keeper of Truck. And so, you know, it's one of the things that kind of makes me think, you know, maybe I should invest finally getting some of these Blu-ray sets, is then it would give me an excuse to kind of rewatch a season like this properly.
Yeah. Well, since you mentioned Megalos, I think Megalos has a bit to offer too. The scenes where they're outside the screens on Zolfathura, Megalos's planet, versus the ones on Tigella are really good. I think it's whenever you nip into thy Tigellan politics with the dodecahedron and all that other stuff, is that's where it's kind of lets down. But the bits with General Grugger and Botradak and, you know, I should like a coat like that bit, and Megalos himself, I think that works pretty well. It seems like it's a holdover in some ways stylistically when you get down on Tigella from season 17 or a Graham Williams type storytelling. And it doesn't really work, I think, very well within the Chris Bidmead season. And maybe this should have been where they, to escape the chronic hysteresis that Megalos puts them in, maybe that's how they got into the CVE, into eSpace. Maybe this would have been the better entry into eSpace or something. There's just something missing with Megalos that doesn't work quite as well as the other stories in this season.
Yeah. No, I mean, well, I mean, I have such a blind spot for both of those because, you know, I didn't watch them at the time.
Right.
And, you know, I had to kind of acquaint myself with them later when they weren't part of that continuum of watching, which, you know, pretty much everything else would be.
Right. So you came to them really with just the DVDs, or did you had missed them onto VHSs too?
You know, I can't actually remember. I can't actually remember when I first watched either of them.
Must have been a big letdown.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was actually. I think it was a big letdown because, I mean, neither of them are that compelling, really.
No.
Are they? No, they're not.
They're generally not the higher ranked Tom Baker stories at all.
Yeah.
Even in season 18, they're at the lower end because as the season goes on, more and more significant stuff
good
happens.
Good stuff happens. Yeah. To be honest, I still get them a bit confused, really.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
I mean, you know, one of them is...
The Fumazi, the little...
No, I mean, one of them is on the Leisure Hive, and the other one is on another kind of random planet of some kind, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think both of them actually fall into that thing that RTD used to talk about, you know, the planet of the... I can't remember what the phraseology, but, you know, the planet of the Wizwazzes, and they have a war against the Ming-Mangs on the planet. You know, it's just... Who cares? Who are all these people? Why are they doing a thing? What is a dodecahedron? I mean, I knew what a dodecahedron was, or still, you know, but why is that a thing? The doctor's a cactus. Okay, that doesn't make any sense. You know, the whole thing is, it kind of is divorced from things that we should be caring about, in my opinion.
I think Megalos is a holdover. It feels like a holdover from season 17. It seems like it fits within like the Creature from the Pit vibe, I guess. And maybe it's theirs because that's the Jungle Planet season where you have Creature from the Pit and then you have Nightmare of Eden and then we have another jungle with Tigella in Megalos. So maybe that's the connection with it. But it just seems out of place in season 18. And so that's, I think, why it doesn't work for me. It doesn't fit within the general storytelling of what Bidmead was trying to do. Even with the Leisure Hive, which is a big rewrite to add all this bits with the tachyons, and it's no longer a gambling planet. So I think maybe if instead of Bidmead spending his time weaving in science, if he would have done a little more weaving in this into maybe e-space or why this is significant, why it worked in, it might tie in better to what he's trying to do, because it's almost as if you could throw away Leisure Hive and Megloss and just start with Full Circle as season 18.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just sitting, I'm looking at season 18 on Wikipedia right now. And if you read the kind of four-line synopsis of Leisure Hive and Megloss, they mostly say exactly the same thing. The Doctor and Romana travel to a weirdly named planet where there's two people fighting against each other. And one of the things they're fighting about is a tachyon recreation generator. And the other one they're fighting about is a dodecahedron. You know, it's just like, it's the same. A deadly war between the Argolians and the Fomassai. The savants are prevented from investigating by the zealous Deons, you know, Deons. It's no good. It's no good. It's boring.
Yeah.
I mean, I wish, well, no, this isn't, if I had a time machine, pretty low on my list of things I do with my time machine, but, you know, I would try and do it is I would, you know, I'd go back in time and I'd regress myself to my 14-year-old self and I'd watch these. I'd be really interested to find out what I thought about each of them at the time. I suspect that actually I would be as irritated with them as I am now, but I don't know. Maybe I wouldn't. Maybe I would have thought they were awesome. I doubt it.
You didn't backfill these with Target novels then either.
No, I mean, I can't remember when these got novelized actually, but I think, again, they weren't part of those classic novelizations.
Yeah, well, Megloss was novelized in 83, so far after Tom's time on the show, and it has the Peter Davison cover on it, etc.
Right. Leisure Hive was 82.
So just a year after broadcast, then, well, 2 years after broadcast.
Yeah.
So not that far, but...
I mean, I'd started reading other things other than Doctor Who books at that point.
Mm-hmm. You had moved on.
I'd moved on, yeah, you know.
And like we were saying, basically up until John Nathan Turner, I think Doctor Who was generally geared towards the bright 8 to 12-year-old, effectively. That was kind of the sweet spot for Doctor Who fandom. And with those kids growing up and becoming organized fans, I think that window drifted a little further mature with JNT's tenure to be late teens. And late teens would show up on British television feedback shows and criticize it. And,
there you go.
And go to conventions or ask actors, you know, the classic question. In this episode back in season 9, why did you look at the other actor in this particular, you know, those type of questions?
Those kind of questions, yeah. Kind of cliched fan questions that sometimes actors like to have, but, and I think maybe nowadays actors are more kind of used to those questions, but certainly they are pretty aggravating.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, it's a dying fall for me, season 18.
Literally.
Well, there you go. Well, yeah, nice one. It is. It's both literally and metaphorically. It is the end of an era.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of, again, it's the end of an era for me. You know, it was the end of my childhood. It was when I started at boarding school. Mm-hmm. It's when I started thinking about, well, maybe I should start watching this show.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot in this season which makes me sad, but, you know, makes me think about not watching the show.
It's the melancholy that overwhelms the season manifest in your own personal reaction to it. Perhaps.
Yeah, exactly. It's a really interesting, I mean, that's a really interesting way of thinking about it. It is supposed to be a kind of, it is a melancholic season. So, you know, if it makes me feel melancholic, it is entirely succeeding. But it's actually was also melancholic because it was when I was starting to think about, well, you know, why am I watching this show? Is this show really for me? No one I know watches this show anymore.
Right.
So, you know, beginning of the end.
For me, this was kind of the beginning for me, because like I've said so many times, loop back to Robot after the first time I saw Legopolis. So I was well into Doctor Who at that point. I was hooked. And so I got to see Hinchcliffe. It was the second time I was seeing Hinchcliffe, but this is the time that I would have the memories being formed. And it was off to the races. Now I was so hooked on this show, thanks to just kind of the wackiness of the Key to Time series, and then just even going through with Tom Baker just picking up where John Pertwee laid down. It worked for me, I guess. There was repeats, there was reruns.
Right,
and so it was just a normal way of watching television in the States. And it just made sense. Oh, we're going to start at the beginning of the show I really like. And I'm now going to understand all the things that happened to get the Doctor to the point where he does fall off the radio telescope.
Right, right.
And so it sort of worked for me, I guess.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Sorry, you referenced falling off the radio telescope. And again, I mean, I think at the time, and I think even now still, you know, it seemed to me to be kind of a sad way for the Doctor to go, basically. Tom was such a strong actor and such a strong character, and I guess I was looking for him to go out in some kind of blaze of glory, which he didn't really.
Well, let's go back in time. After season 17, if that was his last season, we would have had either a really abrupt Colin Baker type exit,
right?
Because he wasn't able to finish filming
True.
Shada, so he would have just left after Horns of Nyman, which wouldn't have been filmed at all. That wouldn't really provide an opportunity. So Armageddon Factor might have been more epic.
Yeah, that would have been kind of epic. But yeah, no, you're right. I mean, you know, again, we can't rewrite history. You know, mm-hmm. Not one line.
And then previously to that, it would have been the Invasion of Time. That would have been a really epic battle with the DMAT gun forcing a regeneration. So that would have been a more epic demise.
Yeah, that would have been fantastic.
Or being shot by Wang Chiang, I guess, at the end of season 14 with the...
Would have been also been good.
Lasers. And then season 13, something crinoid-based. So I guess he's had these bigger season finales up until really season 17... where it ends on a damp squid because Shada doesn't get made. But then season 18, like you said, it doesn't have that bigness to it, even though it's about the Master destroying the universe by star system by star system, because he's meddling with Legopolis.
Right.
I guess the stakes are high, but it still feels
small,
like just a fall kills them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, I guess probably what I was after is, you know, kind of, I don't know, arcs of space electricity of some kind, sort of zapping him, and I don't know. But, I mean, just to kind of fall off something. I mean, again, you know, I know there's something going on when he falls off, but just to kind of fall off like that, it's like, well, okay, he should have just hung on a bit tighter or something, you know, or flown down like he did with Romana off the Eiffel Tower, you know.
Yeah. I'll quickly forget those little throwaway Douglas Adams things.
Exactly, yeah. Why did he just fly down? We know he can fly because he just did it like a couple of years ago. So anyway, whatever.
Yeah.
So there you go. Season 18, A Dying Fall.
But the moment is prepared for.
The moment is prepared for. The moment is indeed prepared for.
So I think, we'll say it, and then if we don't do it, we'll cut it. I think since you've never seen it, and I can't get you a time machine to have you go back to be age 13 or 12 or 13 when you would have seen Shada, since it was never made, but I think we'll watch next the episode, the animated episode, the commercially available official BBC Worldwide or Studios version of Shada next, and talk about that next podcast.
That sounds fantastic. I will prepare my watching devices in order to enjoy that.
All right. Excellent. Yeah. Well, thank you for listening to a duet of the Metabolist 2 podcast. I have been talking to Ben about escaping from e-space.
And I have been gradually getting more and more disappointed.
Nice one.
as the season has continued with David.
All right. Until next time on the Metabolist 2.
Farewell.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
and I've been getting increasingly disappointed talking to David.
I should have said, and I have been getting increasingly disturbed by someone standing on the other side of the room watching me.
Well, if you're rolling, I can put that in.
That's true. I am rolling, actually.